apparently. So
thank you very much, Sansa. So indeed, training, memory, and universal scaling, and the stress on universal, and I'll explain why I stress this, is because it's not so easy to get anything universal in granular frictional matter. I'll make the point even more strong a little bit later. What's the motivation? Well, the motivation is that we really don't know much about what is going on. Frictional dynamics plays an important role in seismic faulting. You all know these phenomena. This is a mudslide that has been here recently. Not here, but like the ones that have been here. This is the result of an earthquake. It'll be awfully important if you learn anything and help in predicting or warning or saying anything useful about these things. This is not going to be the bottom line of this talk because we don't know yet how to do these things, but you know, this is a general motivation. As we all know, the forces supported by the particles in granular systems are not homogeneous in space, but are connected into stress chains that are quite important in sustaining frictional forces. This picture here is a picture I got from my colleague Mahesh Bandi in Okinawa, but it's a picture that is not dissimilar to many of those that Bob Beringer has produced over the years. He's done a lot of work, very important, pioneering. I don't see Bob here, but it's still a fact. And the technique was really pioneered and is based on taking disks, plastic disks that rotate polarized light when they're stressed. So then you shine polarized light from below and you use the fact that you allow only the rotated light to go through. So you see roughly where the more stressed disks are and gives you a feeling about the force chains in this system. Now, the difficulties. There's a very interesting paper already from 1991 by Gary Grest and co-workers, and I just want to quote what they say in this paper because I think it's really fundamental to the subject. It says the fundamental difficulties impeding our understanding lay with the very properties of granular media that make it so interesting to study in the first place. The latency, bistability, arching, segregation, and tixotropy. I had to look in the dictionary what is tixotropy, but now I know. Everybody knows? These properties conspire to create substantial hysteresis and instability, limiting experimental control and reproducibility. Analytical treatments are also difficult because the boundary conditions and velocity distribution functions are poorly understood, and microstructure induces complex correlations among grains. This is all true. Now, more than that, you know, many of us traditionally are interested in phenomena that are universal. Say you want to get something that you don't need to redo in every example of a similar problem, and all these things bear, I mean, really ask a question. Do you have a chance to find anything that is universal in this complicated subject that has all these difficulties? What I want to show you today that I think we have a nugget, a small result. This is a little nugget of a universal behavior that I'm going to discuss. So the subject started with an experiment with my colleague Mahesh. When I say with my colleague, not my experiment, I'm not doing experiments. And the experiment is of the type that has been looked by a number of people in the past. And I think Sri is going to talk about similar phenomena later this week. You have a granular system that is disordered. It has two size disks in 2D. Well, there's of course a third dimensional thickness to this disk, but the arrangement is two dimensional. And you do a uniaxial compression. And when you do the uniaxial compression, at some point you release the decompression. So you go back and forth in an oscillatory fashion. And the periodic compression and decompression cycles. And what Mahesh has shown me originally, you know, like 2 years ago already, he showed me how it looks. That is to say that here black lines are compression legs of the cycle, and red lines are decompression. So you compress and you decompress, and then you compress and you decompress, and you compress and you decompress. And when I saw this, I asked Mahesh, what happens with the area under these things? And he said, well, it goes down very slowly. I said, what does it mean slowly? I believe, he said, slower than any exponential. And this is ignited my interest because, you know, slower than exponential is usually a power law, and if there is a power law, at least in principle, we have a chance to see something that we can say definite things about. So I decided to work on this subject. See also the later lecture by Sastre. And what I want to stress here, that in each such cycle, the system compactifies. Is it right? English, by the way, compactify, yeah? Thank you. It compactifies and the dissipation is reducing because the area under the loop is going down, so the area is directly proportional to the dissipation because, I mean, this is the pressure, this is the Peking fraction, so it's a PV kind of thing. And you have the appearance of the area, it appears that areas reduce very slowly, maybe with a power law. So I wanted to see whether this is really a power law or not, and if it is a power law, can we get something universal about the scaling exponent? So what do we do? Questions that I wanted to ask is, first, is the asymptotic area zero or finite? Okay, you compress, decompress, compress, decompress. You cannot compactify more than something, right? So eventually, you have to repeat the same loop. But is that loop zero area or finite area? That's the first question. Is it indeed a power law? And if it is, it is, what is the power? Is the power law universal? I'll give you immediately the answers so that you're not going to be in deep suspense. So I'm going to argue that firstly, there is an infinite area. Let's say the loops up to the end or asymptotic still have a finite area that I'm going to call A infinity. And the way that the area in the nth cycle decreases is with the power law B n to minus theta, and theta is of the order of 1 up to logarithmic corrections that I'm going to argue logarithmic corrections are very difficult to put a finger on, but the exponent is very easy to put a finger on. And the asymptotic area is finite, of course, due to frictional losses. So even if you are not compactifying further, when you compress and decompress, particles are rotating, and there is a frictional loss that is leading to an area under the loop that you cannot avoid. Okay. Now, the inverse power law, as I say, is up to log corrections that I'm going to explain why it's difficult to ascertain these log corrections. And the power law seems to be universal. It's independent of the friction coefficient, independent of the size ratio of the disk, independent of everything that we can check. Okay, simulations. So we build up these similar arrangements of this. This is now in truly 2D. Okay, this is on the machine, so I can do it really in 2D, and it's binary disk sizes. Of a ratio 1.4 in this case. And the simulations are done according to stuff that has been already standard in the literature, and you can ask Dov about the details. I'm sure that Dov did the simulations himself, so he will know. And I'm not going to go deep into the simulations, I'm only going to tell you that the normal forces are Hertzian, the tangential forces are Mindlin, Coulomb law is imposed in the sense that the tangential force is smaller or equal to mu the normal force, so it's the standard stuff, and here's what you get. So when you do it on the machine, the loops are much more orderly and very much more accurate. So you can really study very carefully what is going on here, and you see that what happens is that you compress, you decompress, but when you arrived to the point here, the Peking fraction is higher than when you started, then the new loop starts here with the blue and goes down with the red, and you still compactify until you cannot compactify further, and it's interesting what happens here. And as I say, the main question they want to ask, which is a small question, but as you see it's a nugget of understanding, is what is the rate of decay of the areas. So theory. Theory is really, how would you approach this? So you see these loops. Now, there is something here that begs a question. You see, you can define the Peking fraction at the high point, at the highest pressure of every loop. So this point here is defining a Peking fraction, this point, this point, this point. Now, it's very natural to consider the difference. So I call psi xn, I call the phi n plus 1 at the maximal value of the power minus phi n at the maximal value of the power. And this xn has to go slowly to zero. Now, what can I say about this xn? Evidently, if I write a map, xn plus 1 is g of xn, this map has to have a zero fixed point, because at the end you cannot compress further. Okay, so xn cannot continue to be finite because the system simply will not become a neutron star. Okay, so we cannot compress above something. So if there is a fixed point with a value zero, x equals zero, now I can expand around that fixed point. Now if I believe that there is a power law, and I have to ascertain that, then the only generic expansion is a start linear. I cannot have a coefficient here, because if the coefficient is larger than one, I'll have an exponential growth of xn. If the power is, if the coefficient... Question? I don't know why you call it a Markov process. There can be a dependence. I don't say that xn is not a function of xn minus 1. I just say there is a map. I mean, a dynamical system like the quadratic map is not a Markov. It has a long memory. So you can have a dynamical system map that is not at all a Markov process. It just says that there is a map, that there is a causal dependence between xn plus 1 and xn. What are the properties of this map? We'll have to find out. And I'm saying I'm now using the fact that I know that this map must have a fixed point that is zero, and at that fixed point I can expand in a generic fashion. So I have to have a linear term with a coefficient 1, and I can have any coefficient for the quadratic term, etc. Yeah. That I need to have a parallel. And what I want to understand is, what is the exponent? It's not guaranteed.
The only power law you can get from this argument is 1.
Yes.
And as
you'll see.
Any power law, you have to have the coefficient of xn.
No, you cannot have a power law if you have a coefficient. You can't have a power law. The only way you can have another exponent is if you don't start with the x squared, but you start with the higher order x, x cubed or x fourth. But that's what I'm saying is non-general. So I'm saying.
Exponents in critical phenomena happen precisely because you don't have analyticity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that this is the case.
I agree with you, but I don't think this is the case here. I think the case here is you get the exponent 1 exactly because of what you say, analyticity, and I point out that if you put any coefficients, you have either exponential blow-up or exponential decay.
Okay.
Now, as I say, the fixed point must be 0, so I can expand around that fixed point, and I know that the sum of xn must converge, because, you know, the sum of xn, you know, it has to go to some phi asymptotic. And the solution, as Jim has immediately realized, is the only solution of this equation for large n is xn goes like c to the minus 1 n. So now this is the xn, it's not the area yet. But the area, by the way, this is in the numerical simulations, you can now look at xn as a function of n. We have here, I don't know, two orders of magnitude in x, an order and a half in n. Not so great, but it looks pretty convincing. And the idea is now that the area that you can estimate in a scaling way as P max on delta volume or area of these loops, and you can now expand around phi infinity and going to be P max, n is the number of particles, a squared, a is just the size of the particles, phi infinity is the asymptotics, and the delta of phi n. So there is a relationship between the a n and the phi n, so the delta a n should go like the same way, and now the question is, what is the asymptotic area? So asymptotic area, you can just measure. And you see, you just look at your simulation and you measure all these slips that you get when you go up and down in the loop. You know what is the energy loss in every slip, so you compute the energy associated with all these tangential slips, and you see that it very quickly it goes to a constant as n goes to infinity. And therefore, you can now write A minus A infinity, where you put this value, and indeed this appears to be very well represented by a power law with the universal exponent of 1. I'll argue in a moment that it is indeed universal. So, as I said, sorry? An. En is the energy that I compute from the slips. Now, the area is proportional to the slipped energy. Okay, so the series of An has to go to an infinite asymptotic value A infinity, and therefore I have to subtract when I do this calculation here.
Is this experiment or numeric?
This is still numeric, so I'm going to come back to the experiment. Look, it's you know, it's a finite size system. I'll tell you what you get into. You get into a limit cycle, and it's a subtle change in the form of the loops, which I believe is the source of the logarithmic corrections. I'll come back to that in a moment. It's a finite size, so you know you have still fluctuations. It you know, sorry. It's a single system. You could do averages over more systems, then it'll be much more flat.
Single system,
and you still have some fluctuation. It still fluctuates. Whether it is going to be self-averaging in the thermodynamic limit.
I'm just wondering, if
it's
deterministic, then you think that if you cycle a bunch of times, then you end up just converging to a fixed point, and then it would be perfectly
So because we don't converge to a fixed point in the area, or in this, I decided to look at the differences in the phi, and that has to converge to a fixed point. So I couldn't do the trick that I showed you before on this because of these fluctuations, but okay. So you have this law that you propose, that An equals A infinity plus Bn to minus theta, with theta is of the order of 1, as you get. And as I say, it cannot be 1 over n, because the series 1 over n doesn't converge. So I said before that the sum of xn has to converge, 1 over n doesn't converge. So you have to have sublogarithmic corrections. And as you'll see, all the exponents are slightly smaller than minus 1, minus 1.02, minus 1.03, and the logarithmic corrections are difficult to put a finger on. Okay, now, so here it is. You see now the difference, and this I have copied here on the board. This is the subtle difference in the way that the loops actually are looking. So when you look at low order loops, you see you go up, you go down, you go to a different place. You go up, you go down, you go to a different phi. Asymptotically, it's very hard to see here. There is an area, but it looks like this. You know, just inverted. I'm sorry, I should look at it this way. So the thing goes up and comes down to the same point, which is different. So there is a change in the nature of these loops, and this is a very subtle thing that I believe is the reason for the logarithmic correction, but, you know, too hard for me to figure out. This, the area of this, because now it's just repeating. Exactly this asymptotic limit cycle that goes back and forth to the same phi, both down and up. Okay, different friction coefficients. So we change here mu from, I can't remember, 0.1 to 0.3, the same thing for the xn and for the areas. As you can see, the exponents minus 1.005, minus 1.005, smells like a logarithmic correction, but you know, need to be shown. Back to experiment. You asked about experiments, so it's now equipped with all this. We get back to Mahesh, say, Mahesh, no, move your ass and get it right. So here it is. So this is now the experimental measurements of the energy loss in every loop. Not trivial, because it's very hard to do it from the loop. So what he does, he puts a sound perturbation. The sound perturbation now speeds up the convergence enormously. You see, when you do this compression and decompression, the events are localized. So, you know, this is why you get this slow thing. Right. This is goes directly to the limit, and you can just measure that loop after you have done this. And I'll show you how this implicates more the experiments in a second.
So when you say the energy, it's not measuring energy, it's measuring area.
Yes. Correct.
So it's really
correct.
Okay. Wait, what's there's circles
and there's
X's.
So these are two different area ratios of the disks.
Gotcha.
Okay. And now you have here.
Can I come back to that? Why are there many more fluctuations in the crosses than in the?
Okay.
Because of experiments. But as Jim noticed, even in the simulation, we have a lot of. He does. No. It didn't occur to me that this will speed up. I mean, if it occurred to me, I would have done it, but he's clever. Okay. Say it again? I didn't do it. I mean, this is post factum, see? I mean, I saw these results after we've already done the theory, and I wanted to see. But I'll show you something very interesting that Mahesh does that I like a lot. So here's the XNs, which he can measure directly. Now this is very interesting. So you see, this is the AN minus A infinity that he measures from here. And the black is just what I did on the machine. So just compression, decompression. Okay. Now you see here he's doing the experiment again with the green dots, 10 loops, and then he puts the vibrations, the acoustic perturbation. Boop! It falls directly to the asymptote. So now the asymptote here, actually this is the asymptote that he has measured. This green is below the asymptote because I'm plotting here A and minus A infinity, so it goes down. But this is it. These are the same. So the moment that you stop allowing the system to build up the memory, oop, it just jumps to the final asymptotic area. And I think this is a very neat experimental, I say, demonstrations that what we're talking here is about a memory that builds up in a parallel fashion as long as you do this in the compression-decompression way, whereas if you put these perturbations, then you can by hand destroy the memory. Yes, Sid?
So I'm kind of confused.
Okay.
When you do oscillations or vibrations on a sand pile, typically you see very slow relaxation. I mean, that it goes logarithmically in time.
Relaxation in what?
In the density.
Okay.
But that goes logarithmically slowly. And here you're saying that you're going instantaneously, basically, to another state.
In the area. In the area. Not the same measurement. Right, so it's the amount of frictional dissipation. I don't know if you ever measured this in a compression-decompression loop. So,
more broadly,
yeah.
I mean, I agree that if shaking produces a logarithm.
This is not shaking, this is acoustic perturbation, but yeah. This is acoustic perturbation, but never mind.
But I think you have an argument, you haven't told us, of why you think compression and decompression with noise leads to the same final area.
Correct.
Decompression.
But without the noise, it's much slower, and it's a parallel.
I understand it's faster, but why is it the same final state?
Why is the same final state? I don't know if it's the same final state, it's the same final area of the loop. Now, I don't know how to put. Statistically, that's the same. Yeah.
They have to be the same statistical final state.
What?
And the noise is not enough to completely reorganize the grains, right? So all the noise is doing is speeding up the frictional stuff. You're not rearranging the state. So, I mean, you basically have the same global state. It's still doing the same, back and forth. Right? You compressed it or decompressed it so much that the whole thing is reorganizing, then you have a different state.
I would think the final area would not necessarily have relaxed all of the frictional constraints in exactly the same I'm agreeing that that as a practical thing, it makes things stabilize much faster, and it looks
like
it's the same final area, but I don't understand why.
Okay, I mean, all that I can say is that if you use the asymptotic form and you plug it in into this law, then you get the power law. Yeah. So, for whatever it's worth. Yes. I'm sure.
Looking at the, so we compressed the same file over and over, and then tracked the decrease in the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And you absolutely do see a power law in that case.
Okay.
I don't have handy one.
Okay. Okay. It's interesting because one can check, you know, because it's, I think there is a strong universality here, at least when you don't have noise, so it's very interesting to see what gets. Okay, conclusions and the road ahead. I promised the chair that this is a short talk. So we have a tiny but apparently robust universal law for training in memory in frictional granular media. I want to say this is really training in memory, because as you see, when you perturb the memory, it goes away. I mean, you don't get this phenomenon at all, it just disappears. Next, what we want to focus is the interesting giant slip event. What is the giant slip? It's something that I have to say I heard for the first time from Jay Feinberg. Jay Feinberg is studying a lot of frictional stuff, fantastic experiments, and he tells me on Friday before they go home, they released the distress, and they always hear at the last moment, pack! So that when things just get relaxed at the last moment. So we looked at it here, and it turns out that when you go down the loops, okay, when you go down a loop, so you go up and you go down, just before the end, most of the frictional slips are taking place. Very interesting. And you could argue this is because the Coulomb law is busted when you reduce the normal forces. So it turns out that when you come close to zero pressure, this is where there are many, many, many slips. At the beginning, we thought that there is a singularity in the number of slips and the energy slip. Now we think there is another power law, that is, the number of slips are actually growing like p to minus an exponent, and we're studying this. This is something that I believe will also give a universal power, but this is still not in the cards. In order to understand this, this requires a detailed understanding of the PDF of normal and the general forces, because, as I say, you need to understand quantitatively how the Coulomb law is being busted, and that has to do with the PDFs. When the PDF of the frictional forces, the tail begins to exceed the tail of the normal forces PDF, and that is something that we are working on, and I think we have progress, but it's still early to discuss. Stay tuned, don't go anywhere, there'll be more of this. Thank you very much for your attention. As I promised, there's a lot of time. But maybe all the questions were already asked. Yeah.
Questions?
In the beginning, before you built your theory, you built a basis around, you know, let's have a simple mapping, you know, with xn plus 1 equals to xn minus, and you have this...
It's not a simple, it's just a map.
No, it's a mapping, okay.
It's only simple near the fixed point.
Okay.
It may be very rich.
Yeah. So, but, you know, in principle, if, you know, you could just check this against your numerics, right?
But it's true. This is, of course this is true. This is true. This gives you the right answer.
Okay, fine.
Of course. No, of course. Otherwise, you wouldn't get this.
Yeah.
This is, yeah, no, of
course. Yeah, and then the deviation from the
of course. Point. Look, I mean, you know that it has to go to zero. So this is one fixed point.
Yeah, okay.
So then, you know, this is the generic normal form, so to speak. So it's a normal form of this mapping near the fixed point. Not necessarily out there, right? Maybe much more complex, but I don't care because I want the asymptotic parallel. The fact that the asymptote always works on the way is one of these miracles of statistical mechanics. It's always surprising, but it's so. Itai.
Yeah, so I guess I'm trying to figure out if shaking and vibrating are the same thing, and whether you guys have looked at the microstructure to see how much change.
So firstly, it's not we guys, it's Mahesh. So
in your simulation, you
In simulation, we didn't do it.
Okay.
We didn't do it. So now, he's not doing shaking and vibrating, he's doing acoustical.
Sorry.
I don't know if it's the same or not, but he's putting it an acoustical resonator. So, so I don't know if it is the same as just shaking or.
Okay, but in the simulation.
Sorry? Sure.
But in the simulations, do you guys look at, what is decompression? How much are the grains moving when you stretch?
When you compress.
Either when you compress or when you relax.
The forces have a pretty strong coefficient in the Hertz law. So they are not compressing very much, maybe 1% or something like this.
So there's not. So that's the question. Is it like what Bob said, where you get rearrangements, or is it mostly staying still and you're looking at the the contact relaxation?
So, there are events all the time. So the events at the beginning are multiple. There are events, that are plastic events of rearrangement. The system is compacting, right? So it has to find more compact arrangements. That is being done by local moves. Some people call it STZ. I don't know if this is relevant here, but these are kind of things. Then at the end, it's mostly frictional events. Okay, so you have a change from something that is both longitudinal and transverse to something that is mostly transverse in this case, and then the energy inside is just the frictional.
And is the idea then in Mahesh's experiments that you have to get to that final state before you put the vibrations on? In other words, if you put the vibrations on before it reaches that final compressed,
then it jumps to that stress.
But that's the point. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe the jumping only happens once you've reached that final state.
No, but I showed you here. I showed you these results for the experiment. So here you do just 10 loops normally,
right,
green
but,
ones.
But that's the point. So the question is, after 10 loops, have you already reached the basic?
Not yet.
No.
We still have a lot to go.
I'm dividing your experiment into two parts. The first part is the kind of thing that Bob talked about, which is a rearrangement, if you want, T1 events, whatever, in the grain topology.
Which
right?
are mostly here.
The contact network of the grain, so to speak.
The neighbor lists.
Right. And so the second one is once you've reached the final configuration, so to speak, then you can put. Then you can start relaxing the frictional interactions. So if Mahesh put on the noise after cycle one, the question is, do you still get the same area? I'm not so sure.
Ah, that I'm not sure either. But let me just make one point, Itai. Itai, but when you say...
If there really are reconfigurations, right, then it doesn't seem to me like it's the same process.
No. That's an interesting question, but I have to make the point when you say when you reach the asymptotic state, you never reach the asymptotic state. It's a power law. So, if you had the patience, this would go down, 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 down. It's a log plot.
I think Itai is suggesting.
Yeah, he's asking whether if you did it here, will it go to the same place?
If you start the shaking before you train it at all, it doesn't know what area to go to.
Okay.
And so,
good point.
And so you
interesting.
Somehow
possible?
The fact that you've trained it some
possible?
Is responsible for getting the right area.
Possible. I mean, all that I wanted to argue is that this destroys the power load that is due to the memory that is building up. That's all. I mean, but you may be absolutely right that if you do it here, it'll go somewhere else.
I mean, just to follow up on the same, so one can imagine that if I start with some initial packing, this procedure of compression decompression leads to some sort of unique state, but this need not be the same depending on which initial condition that you're starting to.
It's very possible that A infinity may depend, but the power law I claim will not depend.
Well, also.
So the universal thing is the power, not the A infinity, and I have no problem with that.
Yeah, and what you're doing here by the shaking is that. you know, in some sort of fashion, I mean, this is a little bit uncontrolled in terms of making a clean thought experiment. Mm. So at some point, you're randomizing within some set of possible states.
Right.
So that is leading to compaction, but presumably, yeah, like I guess we all agree that...
We all agree.
Now...
That's true.
Yeah, one, I had a couple of... So one question is, you know, this logarithmic dependence of the... Sorry.
The power law.
The power law dependence of the area is the equivalent to a logarithmic dependence of the density, right? Which is what...
No. No, no. The delta phi and delta a are proportional to each other at the end. Yeah. Because you have to expand near phi infinity. It's the same power law.
At that level, yes.
No.
But I'm trying to square the fact that people do see a compaction of, you know, I mean, in the earlier compaction experiments, the density does go as logarithmically, but Sid just told me that it's more complicated than a simple logarithm. But is there a relation? Is
it? I have to think about it. I don't know. Julio, you had Bulbul. Well, Bulbul is raising your hand quite ecstatically. Ajay.
Yeah. I was just wondering, is it clear that the friction with the surface is not a big player here? Supposing I do the acoustic vibration.
Actually, it's a very interesting question, I'll tell you.
Because then that might be the one rather than the friction between the particles.
I'll tell you, I mean, we started the problem without friction with the surface in the numerics, I'm saying. You know, in the experiment, it is kept to minimum by, you know, some tricks of my head. But in the simulations, we started without friction, and when you just touch it with the walls, they accelerate. Boom, 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 boom. Becomes horrible. The dissimulation sucks. So we had put a very small friction with the surface, you know, with the surface in order to avoid these complex dynamics to have nice.
Is this friction or static friction?
Frictional laws, yeah. So that you have to have a minimal force in order to move.
Yeah, I was just only meaning that if you put the sound vibrations on the side vis-a-vis from the bottom, it will decipher which frictional coefficient is relevant to have this collapse. That's the question.
Sid. Ah, sorry. Julian.
Okay, so can you say something more about the lot correction? So what is the physical origin and also how they, I mean, how they, let's say, your argument, which is...
So here I'm beyond the full understanding. I believe that the changes, that the log corrections are due to the subtle change in the form of these loops. Okay, so that you don't really do self-similar loops all the way down, but at some point it changes to something that instead of going up and coming back at a different phi, you know, it goes up and it comes back to the same phi. This little change, this subtle change, I don't know how to take it into account in the mapping and everything. And in my judgment, this may be the source of logarithmic correction, but I can't vouch it. So I suspect you have to have logarithmic correction because the 1 over n does not converge.
You say that if you take the, you know the target, you know the actual final area.
Right.
Can't be zero, and you know what it is now. If you sum up your thing with the exponent 1.05,
that'll converge.
It'll converge. Will it converge to something positive, or will it go negative?
No, it'll converge.
So you tried that.
Yeah, of course. No, it'll converge.
Actually,
what I start is with logarithms with log squared. Not with 1.005. 1 over n log n would not converge. 1 over n log n squared converges. And this is what we tried, and it works.
Okay.
So maybe I haven't fully understood it, but there was nothing particular about granular materials in here. That is, if you had taken a sheet of paper and crumpled it up and did the same thing over and over again, your same.
But what would you measure?
Measure the volume.
The what?
The volume of this thing. So you take a crumpled sheet, you put it in, you take it off, put it in, take it off, over and over again, and you watch this thing slowly evolve to an end state.
Possible.
That's the same. But now there, that was done.
Yeah.
And it's been a long time. But my recollection is that there was a kind of a power law behavior for that, but it was not close to one.
The crucial thing here is that we exercise this mapping for the delta phi n. If you have something like that, you know, delta phi n, that is a mapping g xn plus 1, and so the difference is xn and you have a mapping, then it has to be 1. I don't know in this case whether you can identify something like this. No, I tried for a month or two not to do it via the xn's, and it wasn't obvious how to get the power law. Then it was just an idea that...
We should find with this reference.
Okay.
Right?
No, but it's interesting.
If there's a previous experiment that saw something else...
Right. And why? And to find out why.
It was like 20 years ago, so I don't remember what...
Okay, fine.
But...
Who? Bulbul.
I have one other question, which is what I'm asking everybody. So you had memory in your title here, but I've missed the important point about what was memory here? What are you thinking of as memory?
So I think that the memory here is what you do not destroy when you put the perturbation. So the memory is just the what Sri wanted to call the Markov chain, which is not a Markov chain, but that there is a mapping. So you have a mapping, xn plus 1 depends on xn, and xn plus 2 depends on xn plus 1. So you build up a memory, and that memory is destroyed when you do this acoustic perturbation. So for me, the notion of memory was solidified by this experiment when you do this perturbation that changed the power law entirely. And also memory, you see here, if you come to a final loop, then the now system knows where it came from. You know, it goes up, it goes back to the same phi. So you can say memory in various ways, but for me, just the accumulation of compaction in this slow and parallel fashion is what I meant by the memory. Bob, sorry. I'm so excited with this little thing, there's so much discussion. Yeah.
So one obvious question, when Mahesh or whoever does the vibration, and a very important issue is just how robust is the state that you generate. So for instance, when we do that experiment, we generate a state with z equals 4. Z equals 4 is about as dense as you're going to get that material. So basically what you do is you remove all the relaxational process. There's no place to relax to anymore. It's as dense as it's going to get. And so, of course, you don't get any relaxation.
Are you talking about a binary mixture or a pure disk? I mean,
they're bidisperse. Hmm? But same. So this is a bidisperse mixture of disks. But if you get to z equals 4, the system is just really robust. And so you know, there's nothing to relax anymore.
Well, I accept that there's nothing more to relax in terms. By the way, I don't quite understand it, because that depends on the pressure that you go to. When you compress,
right,
you choose the pressure.
When it
goes to this loop, it's at that value of the maximum pressure.
I'm sorry, so what?
When you get to this final loop, it's that value of the maximum pressure.
Right.
If you now increase the maximum pressure, it will have another set of changes. So I don't know whether you talk here about an asymptotic state.
I'm proposing you get to the asymptotic state by applying vibration, and that if you don't vibrate, you're moving towards possibly a different asymptotic state, but the vibration immediately takes you to the asymptotic state, so there's nothing more to relax to.
So your asymptotic state depends upon the maximum pressure you're applying?
Of course.
And your asymptotic state is one that is independent or dependent on the final pressure? I mean, if you shake it hard enough, then you'll get it.
Anyway, I don't think that this shaking is the message here. You know, the
we know, but we're puzzled
puzzled by the shaking.
Yeah. No, so I just want to point something which I wasn't planning to talk on, but I will mention it on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been looking at cyclically deformed sphere packing, soft spheres, and it's not the same thing because you're doing compaction here. And so that's, but there are two sort of observations. I don't have, we're again not looking at the exact same quantity, but we've been looking at how much particles move during one cycle. So the two key sort of observations which are relevant probably here, one is this amount of displacement, which is somehow related to the area, but you know, one has to figure that out. Depends in a power law fashion up to very large numbers of cycles, but it's cut off.
Mm.
Okay, so it's power law,
mm-hmm.
and this is sort of, it has to be that way. I mean, so you said you didn't know how that crossover happens. What we see is that it's a power law that's mm-hmm. sort of cut off reasonably abruptly.
Is this a finite size effect, or is it, who knows?
But the other thing is the exponent that we could extract seems to depend on how much we oscillate.
Exponent for what?
Of the power law. Depends
the measures,
on how
the power law measures. What does it measure again? The power law?
Is the displacement.
Displacement, I see. Okay.
In each step. So, but that depends on the amplitude of the.
I don't say that this exponent is going to describe everything. I'm going to say this exponent has a good chance to be universal for the question asked.
No, but the point is for Mahesh, it would be very interesting to change the amplitude of compression, decompression cycles.
We can do it on the machine very easily. Very easily.
So actually, I can chain on to that. I did the very similar experiments to these in my PhD.
Does everybody do the same experiments? What's
exactly.
Happening?
Exactly. and we Nobody measure exactly what you do, which is that the, but except that we don't measure this area, we measure the, you know, this paper. So you do 20,000 oscillations, and you look at how the volume fraction changes as a function of the number of cycles. You also get power loads there. The interesting thing is I see more like what Sri says, which is that all the data that you showed, I mean, it seems like a subset of the data that he has. For instance, if you were to look at memory, not in the way that Sid implies it, but just say, is it protocol dependent? If you first apply a given amplitude and then you oscillate around that, or if you, so it's sort of strain amplitude plus an oscillation, or if you do a ramp and then you ramp back up at a given velocity.
Is it strain or uniaxial?
So you can do, what we did was uniaxial compression like this.
Like here, yeah.
And it depends, and the results depend on, as Sri says, what the amplitude of that compression is. They also depend, if you go back to your curve at the very, say, at the very front, and you redo the experiment again, you actually get a shift in the numbers that you see. So I think the system is very complex. It's very hard to get the data to actually give you a narrative.
I recommend looking at this measure, and
One thought that comes to me, based on the kind of stuff you've done before a lot, you could actually use the data to construct the map, right, without any...
Data?
To construct this map.
Of course you can.
Yeah.
Of course you can.
That
far from the fixed point, yes. Is it so interesting? I don't know. That maybe is non-universal. No, not that universal is the only important thing in life, but, you know, I have a preference. So I think there is a normal form near the fixed point, which I think is interesting.
Okay, so that brings us to... Should we wrap up or should we wait till 10 o'clock? I don't know. I was thinking we could have a little break now.
Sure.
It sounds like a good moment for cookies and break. And we reconvene at 10:30 exactly. Thank you.